some people being left-handed as being evil, but apparently, more particularly in our area, being left-handed is very important. You can make a strong tea out of the more the older leaves and give it to him, and he counts quite pleasant.
The theme of NAIDOC Week this year is Because of Her, We Can. So today on All the Best, we're going to hear from two influential storytellers, both Aboriginal women. They'll be telling us about how Indigenous Australians have understood the mysterious workings of the land and the sky for tens of thousands of years. To start off, let's meet Kirsten Banks, a proud Wiradjuri woman. Wiradjuri country is in central New South Wales. Kirsten is an astronomer and studied physics at university, so we ask her what she sees when she looks into the sky.
About 10 years ago, it was thought that Indigenous culture had lasted for about 10,000 years, but now, in 2018, we're saying it's over 65,000 years old, and it's still living to this day, which I think is fantastic. A lot of people say it's an ancient culture, but I don't like the use of the word ancient because it implies that it's a dead culture, but we're still around and we're still practicing the astronomy of our culture every single day. In Western astronomy, we connect the dots. We put lines between the stars to create arbitrary pictures of things in the night sky. Some of them make sense, others not so much. It takes a bit of imagination to figure out some of them. If we shift our perspective to an Indigenous perspective, we don't connect the dots. Instead, a single star will be a single object or a single entity. So one star would represent a dog or a dingo or a bird or something else. But there's also another constellation. It's made up using the dark parts of the sky instead of the light parts of the sky. So if you're looking towards the middle of the Milky Way, which is up during our Australian winter, you can actually see, using the dark parts of the Milky Way, a distinct image of an emu. So the emu in the sky is not just a constellation that we can look at for it to be pretty. It also has a lot of uses and that connects to the land as well. So in my country, Wiradjuri, we call this emu in the sky Gugurman, and Gugurman's position in the sky dictates to us when is the right time to go looking for emu eggs. So when Gugurman is low on the eastern horizon, he looks like he's running along the horizon. This is after sunset when he's in this position. This tells us that the emu are running around trying to make a nest to be ready for the eggs. So there are no eggs around just yet. But later in the year, when the body of Gugurman is now directly above us in the night sky, after the sun has gone down, we now see the body of Gugurman not as a body of an emu anymore, but as an egg in a nest. And that tells us now is the right time to go looking for emu eggs. And that has worked for over 65,000 years. In Aboriginal astronomy, they also use the sky to indicate when the seasons are going to change. Now, a lot of Indigenous cultures didn't have just winter, spring, summer, and autumn. They had the wet season, they had the dry season, they had the intermediate season. So they would have different types of seasons. We would use that particular star as a sign that the monsoon season is coming. So there's a star within the constellation of the Phoenix that to the Waterman people, when it's high in the night sky, that tells them that the monsoon season is coming. When you think about famous science communicators, you think of Brian Cox, you think of Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye the Science Guy, they're all males. So we need more female role models for young kids, young Indigenous kids who have these dreams and want to achieve them. They have to know and see that they can do whatever they want to do.
Auntie Fran Bodkin is from the Bidigal clan of the Dharawal people in the southern part of Sydney Basin. Auntie Fran is an author, botanist, educator, and researcher. She's written the Encyclopedia Botanica, a reference guide for over 11,000 plants. We begin by hearing her English translation of the Darawal dreaming story, How the White Waratah Became Red.
Once long ago, there lived a beautiful woman of the White Pigeon Clan who bore the name Waratah. Since the time the spirit woman first drove her talking stick into the ground and it turned into the white flower, only these women who bore the name Waratah were given the duty of attending to the needs of the flower, we now know as the White Waratah. Because she was honoured by being given the name Waratah, it was the duty of this beautiful woman to always attend the Miwa Gawain, the gift of the spirit woman. Many of the young men of the Darawal clans fell in love with this woman, but all respected her wish to remain beside the flower of Corroboree, except one. A great and powerful warrior of the Hawk clan, Mananga, fell in love with Waratah and wanted her as his wife, regardless of her duties or her preferences. Mananga thought that if he married Waratah, he would become the most powerful person in this land. He was a great warrior, the greatest warrior in fact, but he wanted to be more. He was not satisfied. He thought that by marrying Waratah, he would be favoured by the spirits above all others. Firstly, he plied Waratah continuously with gifts, travelling to the great caves to search out and bring back the beautiful crystals he thought would bind her to him. But still Waratah remained with Miwa Gawain, not only refusing Mananga, but also refusing his gifts. Mananga pleaded with Waratah, telling her that if she refused to be his wife, he would die and his spirit would haunt her forever. Waratah laughed, saying that the Miwa Gawain would protect her from his spirit anyway. She was not, never would be, afraid of him. Mananga went away and he sulked. He wanted Waratah, not only because he loved her, but also because he knew that if he did not persuade her to marry him, he would be the laughingstock of all the people. He would never be the most powerful man in this land. He travelled far and wide looking for spells that he could use to bind Waratah to him, but the magic of the Miwa Gawain was too powerful. Nothing he could do could make her forget her duties and responsibilities to the Flower of Corroboree. Finally, he decided that if she once again refused to come with him, he would destroy the gift of Corroboree. He went to the creek at a place now called Appin, where he sharpened his axe on a special rock. Then, hiding the axe behind the feathers of his dancing belt, he went to the place of Miwa Gawain and stood before Waratah. "If you do not come with me willingly, I will destroy the Miwa Gawain," he shouted. Waratah got to her feet in alarm as Mananga took the axe from beneath his dancing belt and moved towards the Miwa Gawain. As he swung the axe at the flower, Waratah flung herself between Mananga and the Miwa Gawain. The axe struck her throat. As Waratah's blood spurted over the white flower, Mananga cried out in grief and despair. He had not only killed the woman he loved and wanted as his wife, but he also had destroyed his ambition to become the most powerful warrior in the land. The Miwa Gawain, who also loved Waratah, saw what had happened and grieved for her. So the people would always remember the terrible thing that had happened. The Miwa Gawain turned Waratah's spirit into the honeybee so that she would always be able to attend the flower of the spirit woman in safety, and never again would there be a need for a Waratah to tend the Miwa Gawain. Also, Corroboree, seeing through the spirit of the Miwa Gawain the events that had happened, decreed that all the children of the white flower would be born red, the colour of Waratah's blood. That is why today, whenever you see the Miwa Gawain, you will also see the honeybee busily attending to it, and to remember the bravery of the beautiful Waratah. All the children of the Miwa Gawain have red flowers, but there will always be a white Waratah, a white Miwa Gawain, to enable the people to seek counsel from the spirit woman. Oh, some of the botanists, and I'm talking now about the early 40s, botanists were saying, oh, there's no such thing as a white Waratah, and, you know, another coloured Waratah at all. And anyway, myself and a girlfriend were walking along a creek down in the Southern Highlands, and there we came across one single bush of a white Waratah. And then we realised that the story was fair dinkum.
Tell us about how you actually came to writing and translating these stories into English.
When Mum died, I was 14. She left her beautiful things to my sister, and she left all her precious things to my brother. And all I got was a box of paper. And I put it away, but no matter where I went to live or wherever I went, I always carried that box with me, but I never opened it until I got married. And I had the courage to open it. And I opened it up, and there was all the stories. Mum had written them down. She had written them in 2H pencil, and the paper had yellowed. So I had this very, very pale scribblings. The stories were only short. When Mum told me the stories, I used to have pictures. I used to make pictures in my brain, and Mum had only put in the really important parts of the story. You know, I knew what she was talking about, so I added in what I saw in the memories of those pictures. It's allowed me to trace those stories. And what I can actually do is, because a lot of the stories travel, and you can actually trace the travels, so that it's like even up in the Northern Territory, there's a story up there of the White Waratah, and there's a story of the lyrebird up there. They've never had a Waratah up there, and they've never had a lyrebird up there. But the story had travelled.
Why do you think she left you this box of writing?
I often wondered about that myself. You know, I wasn't interested in jewellery anyway, but I was a bit jealous that the kids got something tangible. But it didn't matter. You know, I had this box of paper, and when I did finally open it, I thought, oh, golly, if I'd have only opened it earlier. And then I thought, no, this is the right time to open it. And that's probably why, because it may have been stolen or may have been, you know, taken away or burned or lost or something, had I, you know, opened it in all those times again, time before. But she was always pleased. She was the one, although it was Dad got the blame for it, but she was the one who taught me to read and write before I was 3 and a half.
What do you remember about her teaching you to read and write?
She was very gentle. She was lovely. And, you know, she'd hold my hand. She was very proud that I was left-handed, although in going to school, being left-handed was a punishment. One of the teachers at school actually held my hand down on the desk and bent my fingers back so they broke. So I couldn't write with my left hand. To some people, being left-handed is being evil, but apparently, more particularly in our area, being left-handed was very important.
All the Best is a show for new and emerging documentary makers to pitch, produce, and learn. If you pitch an awesome story idea to us, we'll also pair you with a supervising producer. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. The theme of NAIDOC Week is Because of Her, We Can. We're hearing from Auntie Fran Bodkin, a knowledge holder of the Dharawal people, who translated Dharawal dreaming stories passed down by her mother into English. She now reads the story, How the Parrots Got Their Colours.
A very long time ago, all the birds were of one colour, black. For the birds, this was not a difficult matter to deal with. However, for the people of the parrot clans, the difficulty came when their numbers grew so many that they could not tell friend from foe or relative from friend. Now, the knowledge holders of the parrot clans called a great meeting to discuss what could be done. Because of their laws, they could only wear feather cloaks, and the only feathers they could find were black. At the meeting, they considered such suggestions as weaving their cloaks out of the leaves of certain trees, or even using the fur of some of the animals that wandered throughout this land. But in either case, this would mean the breaking of the law. Then one of the knowledge holders, Gunamari, stood up to speak. In her hand she held a pretty blue flower. "A long time ago all the flowers were white," she said. "Perhaps we should ask the flowers how they received their colours." The others nodded in agreement, and they each determined to approach the flowers near their camps and ask them the secret of how they got their colours. Gunamari went to the warabira, growing near her gunya, and bent down beside it. "Tell me, little friend," she said, "how the flowers got their colours." Warabira looked up at Gunamari and smiled. "I do not remember, dear Gunamari. Perhaps you would like to ask Gudayari, the Christmas bell." Gunamari went down to the river and carefully walked along it until she found the shy Gudayari growing in the shade of the midgenberry. "My friend Warabira, Lady Sarsaparilla told me that you may know how the flowers got their colours." Gudayari thought for a little while, then shook her head. "It happened so long ago," she replied. "Perhaps you might like to ask Pokalbi." Gunamari sought out the beautiful Dianella and asked her how the flowers got their colours. Pokalbi shook her head. "I know only how I came to be," she said, and told Gunamari her own story. "Perhaps each of the flowers has its own story." Gunamari then went to the Waratah. "Tell me, Waratah, how did you get your beautiful colour?" The Waratah sighed sadly. "My colour come from the beautiful woman after whom I am named," she said. "Have you asked Bukerikin? Her story is much happier." Gunamari went from flower to flower. Some could remember the story of how they got their colours. Others couldn't remember or simply didn't know. She did not want to return to the meeting and tell them that she had failed. But as she walked along with heavy feet, she accidentally trod on Mogadara, the orchid. "You should watch where you put your feet, Gunamari," said the orchid. Gunamari kneeled down beside the orchid. "Please accept my apologies," she said, "but I am so worried. I did not see you sitting there." Bogodara nodded. "I should not camp so close to the pathway," she said. "Tell me, what troubles you?" "I am trying to find out how the flowers got their colour. I am tired of looking the same as everybody else." Bogodara laughed. "Most flowers have their own stories, but I know how we orchids got our colour," she said. She patted Ganamara's hand with her leaf blade. "We were once only white, you know. Then one day the rainbow came along and dropped all its colours on us. That is why we have so many different colours." Gunamari was overjoyed. Thank you, sweet Gwagadara. I shall never forget you." Gunamari returned to the meeting and sat down in the circle, waiting to be called upon to speak. She was very excited, but she sat very calmly. Finally, the discussion came around to her, and she leaned forward to speak. "All the flowers have their own stories of how they got their colours," she explained. "The Waratah's colour came from the blood of her carer. The colour of Pokalbi's flowers and berries came from the colour of the eyes of the kindly woman from whom she got their name." The other knowledge holders looked at each other. They did not want such tragedy to befall them just so they could get some colour. "But the orchids got their beautiful and many colours from the rainbow," she said. "Perhaps we should try to catch the rainbow." The knowledge holders of the parrot clans were delighted and eagerly awaited the appearance of the rainbow. For many days they waited, and then one afternoon a cry came from the lookout on top of the mountain. "There is a rainbow approaching!" Bila, the black cockatoo, was so excited that he fell out of the tree and lay unconscious on the ground as the other parrot clans cried out in delight. With cries of joy, the clans ran to where the lookout was pointing. Now all this noise and fuss drew the attention of many of the birds, and they too fluttered beside their clans as they danced their way towards the rainbow. The rainbow spirit saw them coming and almost fled in surprise. But in front of them all was the beautiful Gunamari waving to him, a bright, lovely smile on her face. He knew then that they came in peace. Beside her was Bundaluk, a young man of the Lorikeet clan. For a long time he had wanted Gunamari to look at him, but she had always been too busy. Bundaluk leapt as high as he could and collected all the beautiful colours that rainbow had to offer. When he landed beside Gunamari, she gasped with pleasure at his beautiful colours and ran into the rainbow. returning with orange and green, her favourite colours. One by one, the clans followed her, delighted with their new cloaks. Eventually, as the members of the parrot clans grew old and died, they became the brightly coloured parrots that we see in the skies today. The playful sulphur-crested cockatoos were so excited that they flew too high, and all the beautiful colours they had got from their rainbow were changed to white as they flew through the clouds. When they returned to Earth, once again they found that the only colour remaining was a little bit of yellow inside the crest on top of their heads and some more yellow underneath their arms. Gumari and Bundaluk married, and their children became the many kinds of rosellas that chatter away in the trees, amusing people with their wonderful colours and their playful antics. And that is why the black cockatoo can be seen in the skies before it rains. It is searching for the rainbow so that it can be so colourful as the rainbow lorikeets. What I'm doing now is I'm putting together the associations, the plant associations, that groups of plants work together to create food and medicine for everything else and themselves too. One of the melaleucas, it's a paper bark tree, and the various layers were used in those days. The outer layer was used to waterproof the shelters that we had. The next layer in was wrapped around our cooking, because we knew that if you ate too much charred food, you got really bad stomach pains. The next layer in after that made beautiful bandages. But the beauty about those bandages, oh, and nappies, baby's nappies, the beauty of those bandages is that if you peel off one of the layers, very fine layers, which look like a bit of skin, and put it on a burn, the burn will heal. And it will heal without a scar or with minimal scarring. Get a handful of the kanbanji seeds, which is light and feathery and highly absorbent. Stick that onto the paper bark. Put the baby on top of that. Thread all the paper bark between its legs and tie a bit of string around its waist. What you have there is a totally environmentally friendly baby snappy. Oh, the leaves are great. A small sprig of it put into a baby's pillow will stop it from crying. But, and this is the part I love, if you've got a cranky man or overactive, you can make a strong tea out of the more the older leaves and give it to him, and he becomes quite pleasant.
So it's a tranquilizer?
Yes, and it's a very effective one.
As you've been doing this research and those stories that your mum told you, would you say that they make sense in a way that you didn't realise at the time?
Of course they did. Yes, yeah. The stories are there to teach you. And Mum always told me that there's three layers of any story when it's told properly. The first layer is the secret. The second layer is the lessons that you can learn from the story. And the third layer, of course, is the telling of the story when it's done properly. And so that it's not only just a teaching thing, but it also raises you to a higher level of knowledge. And this is important.
This week's stories were by Alison Chan, with help from Julietta Locane and Geneva Gilmore. Auntie Fran read the stories How the White Waratah Became Red and How the Parrots Got Their Colours from the book Dharawal Dreaming Stories, a compilation of stories that she translated into English. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Community Coordinator. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. Tegan Nichols compiles the show. And I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and find all our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe to us on your podcast app.